I hope you had a good lunch. It's always a dangerous thing to try to give a lecture right after lunch, but hopefully I'll be sensitive to the time and the unique blessings and curses of having an afternoon lecture. I'll try to keep this interesting to a certain extent. And so I have some slides. I should say up front, I have some slides, not many, because this is some new material that I'm developing. And frankly, I didn't have time to finish PowerPoints. But I do have some things that I think might be interesting for you. I was able to find some things online that might be helpful. So by way of introduction to this topic, namely just general missions in Bloomington, in light of the unique place that God has placed you in this church, as well as other churches in this area, what can you do to be a blessing extending God's kingdom here in Bloomington? And in I think one particular area that I think you and your churches could benefit God's kingdom is ministry to international students. And again, I don't want to presuppose what you have or haven't done. I don't know anything, frankly, about your history or your past. But so with that in mind, I want to share a little bit of my own story, largely through my father and his story, as well as some thoughts that I have been developing in my own experience with international students, and then offer you some encouraging things to consider for the future. So, by way of introduction, let me just set the scene for you. It's 1959, and a young Korean man knew all his hopes and dreams were about to come true. After many years of waiting and testing and receiving approval, he had just finished an arduous 3-week journey on a boat, not unlike this one. In fact, this is the same, it's not the boat that he took, but it's the same class and the same type of boat in 1959 that was used to transport him from Busan, which is a southern port in South Korea, to Los Angeles. 3 weeks he spent time on this boat, and he was sick for 3 weeks. He said, to this day, he hates going on boats because of that one trip. In 1959, he's still alive today. So he took this 3-week trip from Asia on the SS Jean Lafitte. He still remembered the name of the boat. When he finally saw the promised land, as he thought it was. At first, he couldn't actually believe his eyes when the boat started to approach San Diego. That was the first harbor that the boat was going to reach, because it also had cargo from Asia that was dropping off in San Diego. And in fact, it took his breath away, what he saw. The bright blue sky glistened in the water. These are actually a photo from the late 60s of San Diego Harbor. And so I couldn't find one in 1959, and he didn't have a picture of it. But I tried to get as close as I can. So this is something like what he saw when he entered San Diego Harbor in 1959. All he saw was this bright blue sky glistening on the water, lapping onto the seemingly endless stretches of golden sand, and lined with these magnificent, I think they're called palm trees, is what he thought. I think they're called palm trees. And as the boat got closer, he couldn't believe how many houses and buildings and especially cars there were in 1959. And in so many colors. For him, he described it to me as if it's as if like these lenses that were making him see the world in black and white had come off, and all of a sudden everything was in this like vivid technicolor detail. He was seeing all these bright colors. And the first thing was, he thought to himself, is this heaven? Literally, that's what he said. Could this be heaven? Coming from a war-torn country. The Korean War ended in 1953, devastating the country. So just only 6 years after that, he comes to this. He said, could such a country even exist? I have read of heaven in the Bible. Is this what heaven will look like? Is what he thought. He had finally arrived as an international student, eager to study in this endless land of opportunity. This was my father. This was my father in 1959. He was a 27-year-old who had just arrived in San Diego, and then on the way to Los Angeles. He was a bit older as an international student, but in fact he had already finished his undergraduate degree, a bachelor's degree in aeronautical engineering at that time. One of the up-and-coming majors around the world was airplane aviation, because airplanes were just starting to take off in the 50s. So he wanted to be on the forefront of that. He actually wanted to be a pilot. But his eyes weren't good enough. At that time, he had to have 20/20 vision or something like that. But he had glasses. And so he decided to just learn about aeronautical engineering to start a career in that. And so after he finished his degree at around 23, 24, he did so well at his university, he was asked to stay on as an administrator and as a lecturer, a part-time lecturer. But he knew that for him to excel in this field, he needed to go further in education. And Korea at the time didn't have graduate studies in aeronautical engineering, aviation. And so he decided to be one of thousands, close to, 5,000 to 6,000 students, college graduates, would take the what's called the entrance exam to even qualify for 200 spots per year to get a passport as a student from the Korean government. So he studied for this exam. He actually was one of the 200 that was chosen to get his passport. But that was not all. Then you have to go to the U.S. Embassy and take another exam to qualify you in terms of your understanding of the English language. So he studied more, took his what would be the equivalent of what we call the TOEFL, Test of English as a Foreign Language, and he was one of the few that passed. So then the U.S. Embassy gave him a visa, a student visa. But then he had to get into a school. So then he applied some more, got into a school. He actually ended up going to USC. Perhaps you've heard of this small college in Southern California with a decent football program. So my dad's a USC. I grew up as a Trojan. I'm sorry if that bothers you. Hopefully they're not too many. I don't think Indiana and SC has a big rivalry. That's Notre Dame, isn't it? If they're Notre Dame fans, I apologize. But you're doing better than us this year, so you should be thankful for that. So my dad went to USC, got his bachelor's and master's there in engineering. But when I talked to him about his experience as an international student, it was interesting to hear what worked for him, what didn't work for him, and what really helped him. Remember, he started his life here with really little. With what little he was able to scrape together, he came with just a suitcase, a really upset stomach, and about $300 in his pocket. That was all he had. He had no friends, no family, little money, little language proficiency, and yet he had a big dream. A big dream that one day he would reap benefits for his future and the future, actually, of his country. For his desire was to study here and then go back and to be a blessing for his nation that was war-torn and had nothing, literally. And so while this is my dad's story, and I know a lot of the internationals that you might meet or come into contact with here in Indiana are different, I think many international students can resonate with much of the sacrifice needed, as well as the isolation and loneliness felt as a foreign exchange student. And here in Bloomington, I think you have a very unique mission opportunity to provide a unique ministry for students like my dad. You see, while the first years of his life were full of many difficulties, challenges, trials, not only was he going to school in a language that was very foreign, he was working 3 part-time jobs just to make ends meet, even working through the night as a short order cook. He was, making eggs and bacon. It actually worked out really well because he got free dinner and free breakfast every day. Because he would work and eat dinner there and then get breakfast, but he had barely little sleep. Because literally he would work through the night, and that's how he survived. It's a remarkable story of sacrifice and diligence. And I'm really who I am today because of my dad, because of his hard work and desire to provide a better life for his children. So while it was full of many difficulties and challenges, one place where he found extraordinary comfort and hope was at the church that he began to attend. He attended a Presbyterian church in Los Angeles that had a special ministry to international students, and they just loved on him. Didn't ask much from him. Because as you know, student ministry is really hard. Because you have to give a lot from the church, and you don't get a lot back. They're usually poor tithers, generally speaking, but they eat a lot. That's what students are, basically. They don't tithe well, but they take a lot of food. But that's our calling, isn't it? To give, just like Jesus gave. And what's interesting is, my challenge, I think, to Bloomington is interesting, the name Bloomington, is to really take heart the words of one of the saints of old who said, bloom where you're planted. God has planted you, God has planted this church in a unique town with a very prestigious university that attracts top-level international students who essentially can become leaders in their own country. The cream of the crop, essentially. And you have this wonderful opportunity to bring Jesus into their life. And so again, my challenge to you all is, can you bloom where you're planted? Now, not everybody can do this. Not everybody lives in a university town like this with this unique opportunity. And so what I want to do is to challenge you in three areas. And so the rest of my talk will follow this outline. To challenge you to bloom where you're planted by, one, developing a burden for the international student. And so what I'm going to do is share with you a bunch of statistics about international students, who they are, where they come from, what are they studying, and why are they so important. Then secondly, to talk about what the Bible says about international students. Yes, I think the Bible talks about international students. Hopefully I've piqued your interest a little bit. Right? So the Bible, what does the Bible say about international students? And then third, I'm sorry I couldn't find a B, but it's close, watch. Third, what can you do to embrace, not that, huh? Not that. To embrace international students in your life and in the life of your church, okay? So a burden for international students. What does the Bible say about international students? So that ultimately you can embrace international students in your life and in the life of your church. Life in your life, the life of your family. Now, by way of disclaimer, I have to admit, talking about this in just 50 minutes or so is very difficult. Because what we're doing is we're covering multiple countries, multiple cultures, multiple churches, multiple expressions and programs. So it's very hard to generalize in this area. However, I'm going to try to do my best to give you what I've discovered and what I've learned, not only from my own experience, but also from my research. So again, just keep in mind that this is just really skimming the surface and just kind of giving you kind of a bird's eye perspective, another B, a bird's eye perspective of this topic. And secondly, I don't want to assume, by way of caveat, that you haven't done this or you're not doing this. I don't know. And so this is an opportunity for you to then teach me from your own experiences what you're doing with international students, etc. And then lastly, my own experience and understanding is somewhat limited. So there are a lot of other resources out there that I think you can learn from. So with that in mind, first, let's talk about first the burden. Burden for international students by sharing with you some statistics. How many international students are here from foreign countries studying in the United States? Do you know how many total? If you were to guess, how many international students studying in the United States today? Guess? 80,000? 90,000? 100,000? That's a lot, huh? Would you believe 819,000? Almost a million students from foreign countries are here in the United States studying. Just look at those statistics. Currently, there are 819,644,000. That's last year's statistic, 2013. Enrolled at both public and private institutions of learning here in the United States. This is data from the Institute of International Education. This is their slide. I can't create nice things like this, so I need to footnote, so I'm not plagiarizing here. It's there. I just pulled it off the web, and it looks nice though. Very helpful. Compare this number just to 1993. Just in 10 years, it's doubled. And now look in 72. To 92 to 2012, or 1812, whatever. Look at that number. 1812, 1892, 1982. Look at the numerical exponential growth. Apologize, numbers are not my specialty, even though I am Asian. I was a humanities major, not a math major. So I apologize if the math doesn't quite work out. But don't let that fool you. We're still the minority. So all that to say, look at that number. It grew by 7% over the prior year and is now at a record high. Where do they come from? We have about 820,000. The largest percentage of students in the United States come from China. And you can probably just from your own experience, you've probably discovered that. That number represents the number of China there. 30% about is 200 and almost 40,000 students from China in the United States alone. 29% of the total. Second is India with 12%. That's about 100,000. The third, strangely enough, is a small country called South Korea. Perhaps you've heard of it. Woo! Yes, I'm Korean if you didn't know. 9%, 10%. Not a large country, and yet many Koreans place a high value on education and will sacrifice much to send their children to to the United States and other places to study. Rounding out the rest is four. Number four, Saudi Arabia with about 45,000. Canada, I mean, is that a foreign country? I suppose so. Yeah, technically, it is a foreign country. So Canada has, 3% there. That's about 27% than others. Taiwan, Japan, Vietnam, Mexico, and Turkey. As you can see, the large percentage there is from Asia. In fact, half of all international students here in the United States are from China, India, and Korea. So from Asia. So potentially, one in two international student you meet will be from Asia. So we're going to focus my comments on Asian culture and what we can do to understand that. Okay, where are they? So this is who they are. Where are they? You'll see the number one state that has all the students are, the number one is California. And California universities is the number one state. Number two is New York. Number three is Texas. And these three states, California, New York, and Texas, represent about 60% of all international students. You may be wondering, where is Indiana? Because it's listed here, right? Of all the states, Indiana is actually number 10. Indiana alone as a state has almost 25,000 international students. It's an astounding number. 25,000 international students in the state of Indiana. The largest single university with international students is University of Southern California, USC. In California, it has about 10,000 foreign exchange students, international students at USC, which was where my dad went in 1959, strangely enough. So my dad was there at USC. Now they have about 10,000. Number three on the list is Purdue. Purdue has 9,500. Any Purdue grads? Yes, Purdue grads. Purdue has 9,500 international students. That is an astounding number. It's 10,000 students. What about Indiana University? Anybody want to guess? Anybody even know? Yeah, very close. Indiana University is actually 6,500 now. As of last year, 6,547 as of last year. 6,547 students are international here at IU. Number 13 in the nation. Again, astounding. What's the total population of IU students? Does anybody know? I don't even know. 40,000? So somebody do the math for me. 6,000 or 6,500 of 40. It's more than 10%, right? 15%? Is that about 15? Right? That's 60, a little bit over, about 60, 16%? Still pretty good at math. Not bad. Yes. About 16% of the students at IU are international. What a tremendous opportunity. What a tremendous privilege to bring the gospel of grace, the beauty of the gospel of Jesus, to people who may not even know they need it, but deep down they know, because many of them are broken, isolated, and hurting. And so, here, what are they studying? 41% of international students in the United States are actually undergraduate. I was surprised by this number. I assume that the majority would be graduate students, already having done their college, but it's not. More and more undergraduates are coming to study here. 40% graduate level, graduate level, 38%. So it's fairly equal. But what numbers is that? Undergraduate students, 41%. That's 340,000 undergraduates in the United States. Graduate level, 311,000 graduates. And then about 21% over in this area for kind of non-traditional practical training or non-degree programs. But what are they studying? 22% was the most popular field. 22% of international students are studying business and management, primarily to go back to their country for economic reasons, etc. The second one is engineering with 19%, and math and computer science. Now, I'm assuming, I don't know much about IU, I apologize ahead of time, but I've heard that IU, Purdue, etc. has very strong engineering, math, computer science programs. Is that true? That's what I've been told. No? Yes?
We don't have engineering.
Is that Purdue has the engineering?
Yeah.
Okay. And a business school?
Yeah.
There you go. So business, math, computer science, probably here in IU, etc. But not engineering up at Purdue, perhaps. So here's what they're studying. So, why give you all this information? One, so that you can be astounded, first of all, by the sheer enormity of people that are right here on our doorstep. See, what I'm trying to argue in terms of developing a burden for mission, we all know that part of our calling is to share the gospel of Jesus. As we think about missions, primarily in terms of what's over there, usually over large bodies of water, like the Pacific or the Atlantic. That's missions, right? To go to people who so desperately need American Christianity. Literally, that's really how we thought in many ways over the years. So oftentimes it tended to be very parochial, very inferior, superior type of attitudes. So they didn't just bring Christianity, but they brought American culture along with their Christianity. Sometimes for good, sometimes not so good. And I can speak from my own experience from my own missions history in Korea. And we'll talk about Korean missions history tomorrow morning. It's very fascinating. But I share all that with you because missions is no longer about going over there. Because why? God is bringing people here. It's reaching those who are now coming here. And I believe your church has been planted in a very unique location. And so I think God is calling you to bloom in Bloomington. To bloom where you're planted. God has uniquely placed your church and you as individuals in a place where you can exponentially bless not just individuals, but their circles of influence, not only here, but in their home country. And think about the exponential benefit that that creates. One example, my father. After finishing his master's degree at USC, he actually went back on his promise to come back to Korea to teach at that university. He told the dean, I'm going to go to America, get a master's degree, and I'll come back and be a professor where he studied. He didn't do that. America was too nice. They had hamburgers, for goodness sake. Seriously, he came and became a short order cook, working the graveyard shift, and he said, I don't know how many hamburgers I ate. But it was remarkable. Just a simple patty with buns and lettuce and ketchup. He was just, maybe that's where I get the craving for White Castle. I don't know. It's from my father, you know? But he said, you know, just life was so much easier here. Then he got married. He had been dating my mom ever since they knew each other since junior high. So then he saved up enough money to bring her over in 1963. My mom and dad got married in 63 in Los Angeles. Then all of us were born in the 60s. And so he's looking at his life. He was working at an engineering firm at that time. My kids are here. They're going to get a great education. Do I want to go back to literally third world country at that time, Korea? So post-war, it was a third world country. In 1953, the GDP, the average amount of money a person made in Korea was the same as Ghana in Africa. Ghana and South Korea in 1953, same. Now look at Korea. In just 50 years, Korea has just exploded to become a first world nation. Even to the point where now, in the top 5 cities in the world that are the most expensive to live in, Korea is number 4. Seoul is number 4. Strangely enough, Moscow is the most expensive city to live in. And then you can imagine London, number 2. 3 is actually Tokyo. Tokyo is very expensive to live. And then Seoul. It bypassed Paris, New York, and other cities. Seoul has become an incredible city. Any of you been to Seoul? Excellent. Wonderful. What a remarkable city. I don't know what your experience has been like, but I travel to Korea about once a year to teach and be involved in different educational opportunities. And it's just a remarkable place. It's one of the cleanest cities I've ever been to. And probably one of the most wired cities in all the world, outside of maybe Scandinavia. The wireless systems in Korea are astronomical. I'm down in the subways, you know, 4 or 5 feet stories underground, and people are watching through the internet their favorite soap operas on the subway, on their little Samsung Galaxies, you know, etc. Down there, all the subways are wired. And then in the wintertime when it snows, it snows here in Indiana, right? Yeah. It doesn't snow in California. I don't know what it's like. But apparently they've now installed in all the major thoroughfares in Korea these thermal devices along the sidewalks and the gutter systems so it melts the snow right there. Incredible amount of engineering and computer feats that have accomplished just in 50 years. All that to say, in terms of the burden and the blessing, my dad had an opportunity to go back. So we actually moved back to Korea in 1970. I was only 2 years old. So you can do the math. How old is Julius Kim? So I was 2 years old. My father had an opportunity to take over a company that had become bankrupt, an American company, an engineering company that made computer parts. At that time, remember, this is 1970. Computers were just starting to take off. And my father learned about computers. And he eventually, his company grew so big, within 10 years, he had over 1,500 employees. So what does this do for an economy? What does this do for a nation? Because now he's bringing back the technological things that he had learned here to a country that so desperately was trying to grow. And it was during the 70s, during the period of President Park Chung-hee, or Chung-hee Park, kind of an iron-fisted dictator, former general, ruthless leader, but really the one who industrialized Korea in many ways. So it was the same time period. So providentially, God brought my dad back at a time where Korea was trying to rebuild itself, or just build itself, from a third world nation to a second world status to eventually a first world status, to the point where he did that. So what does he do? Because of the profound influence of Christianity in his life, he became a convinced Christian. He then, at his factory, you could do this in Korea, I don't know if you could do that here, but every Friday afternoon, he would, after the lunch hour or right before the lunch hour, he would pay everybody for the whole hour. Let's say 11 to 12 or 12 to 1 or whatever it was. He would pay everybody to sit in the large cafeteria where he would feed everybody. So a lot of the factory workers worked through lunch. They provided lunch there in the factory. He would invite local pastors to come and provide a worship service, devotional, every week on Friday to share the gospel. At that time, not many Christians in his factory. When I asked him, about how many people do you think came to Christ as a result of that ministry? He goes, oh, Julius, I don't know. Very humble man, my dad. But looking back, as I talked to my mom and others, thousands came to Christ through that ministry. And all because a small church, a Presbyterian church in Los Angeles, decided to love my dad, to help him grow in the faith and make an impact in his life. So then he now, wherever he was planted, he bloomed and bore fruit. From that simple act of loving the international student, thousands of people came to Christ because of my dad. Not because of my dad, it's ultimately because of Christ and the gospel. My dad was just an instrument to do that. But because somebody decided, let's love these international students who have come here. I know they don't have probably a lot to give to us, but God somehow placed them in our lives. What can we do? God has planted us here. Let's bloom. So that's the burden. That's the burden. And that's it of the slides, okay? So you don't have to look up here anymore. So now that I've talked to you about the burden, secondly, what does the Bible say about international students? Yes, the Bible does talk about international students. It doesn't use the word international student. I'm sure you know that. But I think it does. It talks about this category of people, especially within the history of Israel. And they have been in our Bibles, English translations, they're translated in a variety of different words. Some you may find the word stranger. Some translations use the word alien, foreigner, and even sojourner. Frankly, those are weird translations. First of all, stranger, well, frankly, it's just strange. It just connotes strangeness. And so that's not the most helpful, right? Alien, you think of extraterrestrial, of course. Sojourner, I don't think I've ever used that in my life in my vocabulary. Does anybody use the word sojourner anymore? And yet, in our English translations, those are the words that are used for this Hebrew word. I'll just give it to you so it's easier, because I'll be referring to this word rather than saying stranger, alien, sojourner. I'll just say ger, G-E-R, is the Hebrew word that's primarily used in the Old Testament and in Hebrew history, Old Testament Israelite history, to refer to this category or class of people that are non-ethnic Israelites. So these are foreigners from outside countries, countries like Egypt to the southwest, to Assyria on the northeast, to Edom, and even some of the Canaanites that were still in the land. We're going to talk. So these are the kind of foreigners, strangers, aliens. These are the ger that somehow find their way in Israelite towns, living among these ethnic, racially homogeneous, religiously homogeneous, socially homogeneous, more so than in many of our circles. They somehow end up living and working in these areas. It's very interesting what the Bible says about them. What's more interesting is what God says about them. How He views the Ger. These strangers, aliens, sojourners, foreigners, international students, perhaps, in this category. Back to my father. My father came to the United States. He was just an international student. He had like what's called, back then it would have been an F1 visa, able to stay here for only a couple of years, but he applied eventually for resident alien status. Back then it was called the green card, because that was actually green. I don't know if you've ever seen these. They're no longer green, but we still call them green cards. So he had the status of being allowed not only to study here, but after graduating, to work here. See, he's not allowed to work in the United States as a student unless you're granted resident alien status. So he had some privileges as a resident alien. Unfortunately, he could not vote. As a resident alien, you had to pay taxes to the government. Government's going to get their money. But you could not vote. Remember this at all? Taxation without representation? It leads to problems, but not with my dad. It was okay with my dad. He didn't mind not voting. Now, interestingly, that was the law in the United States. And it's changed a little bit now, but it's essentially the same. Resident alien status is what a lot of aliens have here in the country. They have to pay taxes, but they have different kinds of laws that limit what they can do and what they cannot do. Interestingly, the Bible itself also has specific laws of how the ger ought to be treated. Very interesting. And so while the Bible doesn't say anything specific about international students per se, it does have some very interesting to say about these strangers, aliens, sojourners, foreigners, who left their home country to try to find a better way of life in Israel with God's covenant people. Now, before I talk about more specifically some of these case laws and about God's own heart toward the ger, let me give you some background of what's happening during this time period of Israel. A little bit of background to the Bible's view of this group of foreign people residing in Israel. When Israel first came into the Promised Land with Joshua, one of the strict commandments of God was for the Israelites to wipe out all the Canaanites, to actually remove them from the land because they were a scourge because of their evil, their godless ways. And so, well, I can't get into a large theological discussion about that particular doctrine, but the Holy God said, wipe out all the Canaanites. I think part of the reason why is because He knew that if they didn't, the Canaanites still living in the land would cause problems to the Israelites. Problems of idolatry, intermarriages, etc., etc. That would pull them away from worshiping the one true God. Israel, unfortunately, did not wipe out all the Canaanites. They did not obey the Lord. And for many generations, the Canaanites were kind of a thorn in the flesh in Israelite history. Now, aside from the Canaanites, the general tenor of Scripture, as we read about these strangers and aliens in Israel, the general tenor of these Old Testament passages that we read about, especially as it deals with God's general attitude and treatment of these ger, is actually profoundly pro-life. God's general attitude for them was a good one. For example, one of the laws that God gave to Israel whenever Israel went to war against other nations was rather than going directly into war, God always told His leaders, offer peace first before going into war. Before I give them into your hands, offer peace. It's very interesting. And for those of you who are into the preservation of our world and earth and things like that, one of the interesting case laws is when you do go into another land in warfare, don't cut down the fruit trees. They're not your enemy. Save them. They're good. They're beautiful. They're good things that I've created. So actually, God has a heart even for fruit trees. So interestingly enough, God had these very interesting ways of viewing foreigners and even foreign trees. That was profoundly pro-life. Also, remember the background here, where Israel is situated geographically, which I think is very providential, very interesting. Remember, Israel inhabited territory that contains strategic trade routes with probably the two of the largest and greatest and most magnificent empires of that time. One being Egypt. Even prior to Israel taking the Promised Land, Egypt had established millennia-year-old empire, One of the most impressive empires ever in the history of mankind. That's right, one area. And one of its major trading partners was Assyria, what we call the Mesopotamia area, current day kind of Syria, Iran, Iraq. And in order to trade, they would have to go right through Israel, interestingly. And so God places Israel in this unique cross-section of foreigners, foreign culture, foreign people. Why? Is that on accident? I don't think so. Because I think even in the Old Testament, God is a God of mission. Even though in the Old Testament, He primarily chooses Israel as the primary country with whom He would display His love and show His mercy, with that, He has in mind, through Israel, blessing all the other nations. And we see that ultimately come true through the personal work of Jesus. As now the gospel opens up, the gospel of grace opens up from Israel to all the nations. But we have hints of that, even here. That God is a God of mission, even in the Old Testament. He wants His Israelites, who will undoubtedly come into contact with foreigners from Egypt, from Assyria, to be a part of His mission of love, forgiveness, provision, and protection. So again, it's very interesting and providential to see where God plants the Israelites. And essentially, He's calling them to bloom. Bloom the gospel where you're planted. What's the point of all this background information? Again, like I just said, it's God seems to be very strategic and intentional in placing us in our lives where He wants to use us. And I think we need to be very sensitive to God's voice and to God's way of orchestrating our lives to see, why has God placed me in Bloomington? Why has God placed this church in Bloomington? Why do we have over 6,500 international students? Many of whom represent the influential families and governments of other countries. Why? Maybe God has a mission to spread the gospel through them. So, in light of that background, let me just do a few thoughts about, give you some background now about these specific international students in Israel, so to speak. They're not all students per se, but these ger, the strangers, aliens, and sojourners. What do we know about them? The Bible doesn't say a lot about these strangers, foreigners, aliens. But what we do find in places like Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, there were probably, as I mentioned, Egyptians, probably Phoenicians because of the sea trade, Assyrians, Moabites, etc. All the nations that are around there for trade, etc. These are foreign nationals who did not belong to the racial, cultural, religious, political, and social community of Israel. They were outsiders in more ways than one. They were not just racial outsiders, but religious outsiders, social outsiders, political outsiders, cultural outsiders. Now, why would they leave their countries? Not exactly sure, but it seems like, from the testimony of Scripture, that many settled in Israel because of the trade routes. So they stayed there for business purposes. Some would have to escape famine. You know the story of Ruth, right? Ruth and Naomi. Ruth is from Edom. Marries an Israelite man, but dies. Naomi brings her back to Israel because of famine in the land. So that's how Ruth, this foreigner, comes into Israel. She's this foreign international that comes into Israel. So maybe famine, probably because of civil war or tribal conflict. Not unlike what we face today in places like Syria and South Sudan. People have to move because of war. So that's another reason why they come. So these are some of the reasons why people are coming to Israel. One interesting thing we know is that based on the documents we have available today of ancient law codes, like the Code of Hammurabi, for example, is an ancient law code. The Bible is an ancient law code. At that time period, we have several ancient law codes, not only from Israel, but also from other countries at the time. What's interesting is that based on what the scholars have discovered, the Bible and Israelite case law is the only ancient law that had any provisions for foreigners. Very interesting. No other country at that time period had case laws that were primarily positive for the foreigner. In fact, in most countries, foreign nationals were primarily considered, as you can imagine, slaves, chattel property. Not unlike what the Israelites faced in Egypt. Right? That would be a good example of what foreign nationals would experience in other countries. Very oppressed, undervalued, abused, exploited as cheap labor. And we saw that in the history of Israel in Egypt. And yet ancient Israel was the only country where God goes out of His way to tell His people, that's not the way we're going to do it here. Very interesting. It's actually quite remarkable. And so I want to just share two ways in which God treated the foreigners and how He expected His people to treat foreigners. Just two ways in our limited time together. One, two things. One, first, God's attitude and treatment of the stranger or the foreigner or the alien, the ger, was one of love. Very interesting. A key passage here is Leviticus 19, verses 33 and 34. Leviticus 19, 33 and 34. Listen as I read this. When a stranger, when a ger sojourns with you in your land, you shall not do him wrong. You shall treat the stranger who sojourns with you as the native among you. And you shall love him as yourself. For you were strangers in the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. Interesting. Does it sound like the second and greatest commandment? You shall love your neighbor as yourself? It should. Because right before this passage, in this is Leviticus 19, verse 33 and 34, in Leviticus 19, 18, God gives this very command to the Israelites, love your neighbor as yourself. And now He expands on this idea. What does it look like to love your neighbors? Now, your neighbor includes these strangers that dwell among you. Let's take this one step further. God is saying, it's one thing to love your neighbors who are racially and religiously very similar to you. It's another thing to show the same love to strangers who are very different from you. Arrive from foreign places with foreign cultures. Eat crazy food. They don't even know how to dress appropriately. And yet God commands Israel to love them as they love themselves. He's basically saying, don't put them on the back of the bus. Don't give them just your scraps. Treat them as you would your own children, yourself, these foreigners. Remember, these are very challenging words to Israel. Again, place yourself in that situation in Israel. Here in this passage, God reminds them of who many of these foreigners are. They are from Egypt. They're former oppressors. They're former slave owners. And yet God calls on them to remember the time when they were strangers and aliens in Egypt. God calls on them to remember what their difficult life was like, how challenging it was, the trials and tribulations that they went through in Egypt. He calls on them to remember what it felt like to be marginalized, neglected, and oppressed. And not just as aliens in a foreign land, but as slaves to a brutal people. And now in this strange reversal of fortunes, God actually calls on them to show the Egyptians love, mercy, protection. Deuteronomy 10:19, Deuteronomy 23:8 echo these same words. God calls on Israel to welcome and love Egyptians. And this would have went again totally against the grain of the Israelite. Think about that. These are their hated enemies. The ones who oppressed their fathers and their grandfathers. So I'm sure they heard stories about what it was like to be slaves in Egypt. So this is shocking. God commands them against their natural inclinations. Naturally, what do you do with your enemies? You hate them. That's the natural way. But God's ways are not just natural, they're supernatural, aren't they? God calls on us, covenant people, to be more like Him. In addition to this Leviticus passage that talks about loving as God loves them, loving them as yourself, there are other passages in the Old Testament. There's too many to mention, but let me just mention a few other interesting passages that talk about God's love for the foreigner and how that challenges us to love. In one passage of Scripture, aliens are actually granted the blessing of Sabbath rest. That's very interesting. Again, the Israelites, this is part of their own religion, part of their own cult. This is theirs. We get Sabbath rest. This is what distinguishes us from all those pagan nations. This is what makes us special. And God says, not just you. Don't work on the Sabbath. Rest. Enjoy me. Enjoy God's people. Don't work. And by the way, don't force your slaves to work either. Don't force the foreigners. Though you may be tempted to do so, and though it will be very natural to do so, to keep your factory running while you're at church in Jerusalem. No, give them rest too. Give them Sabbath rest. Rather than being exploited, these aliens are allowed to learn and experience God's pattern of work for 6 days and God's pattern of rest for 1 day. The aliens could possibly then learn the pattern of Sabbath keeping, 6 plus 1, which helps one from the twin extremes of either being lazy, on the one hand, having 7 Sabbaths, or being a workaholic, or having no Sabbath. The twin extremes, which I think the Sabbath teaches us. And so it's very interesting here that even the aliens are invited, or actually commanded, to participate, or at least be given the option to participate in the Sabbath rest, which is specifically for Israel and their religion. More, another interesting passage in the Bible, again, the story of Ruth. Foreigners are allowed to glean from the fields, remember? And so God specifically tells the Israelites, when you're in the fields and you're gathering your food, your harvest, leave some behind. For who? The widows and orphans and the ger. Again, they're allowed to work for their food, and they're allowed to participate and gather food for their families, to give them dignity, but to also provide for their families. What a tremendous God to allow these foreigners to be able to do that, who cares for them deeply, loving even the foreigners in that way, commanding the Israelites to have compassion as He has compassion. But wait, there's more. It's like an infomercial, but wait, there's more. Not only do they get Sabbath rest, the opportunity to work and glean from the fields, oftentimes the strangers, as I mentioned before, are often grouped together with the widows and orphans. Isn't that interesting? In the Old Testament, they talk about the widows, the orphans, and the aliens. And He categorizes these foreigners in the same categories of widows and orphans. Who are the widows and orphans? In the social system, in the social structure, those are the most vulnerable. The most liable for exploitation and oppression. Women and children. Without the protection of a family, of a man. And interesting, God places foreigners in the same category. So as you love, as you provide, as you protect the widows and orphans who are so easily vulnerable, the same goes for the foreigner. View them that way. That's how I view them. I view the widows and orphans with such compassion, mercy, and love. I view the foreigner in the same way. Those who lack the natural social structures of support and protection from potential abuse, exploitation, and oppression. God reminds us of how God views the weak and the vulnerable, and how they need both mercy and justice. This is God's heart for the international student, for the ger, for the stranger, foreigner, alien. That's how I'm applying this. Imagine how these strangers and aliens and foreigners would have felt. What other God does this? What other nation has a God like Yahweh? And this is actually one of the main ways how strangers became followers of Yahweh. Because of the compassion showed to them by Israel. Now, was Israel perfect? Far from it. They were abusive. They were oppressive. And yet this is God's heart. This is God's law. This is God's command. So this is the first thing God shows us about His own heart, that His heart toward foreigners was one of love. But secondly, and more quickly, God's heart also reveals a heart of forgiveness. Very interesting. Not only a heart of love, an attitude of love, but also actions of love, but even attitudes and actions of forgiveness. Key passage here is Numbers 15, 13 through 16. Numbers 15, 13 through 16. Let me read this. Every native Israelite shall do these things in this way. He's actually talking about sacrifices at the sanctuary for forgiveness. So forgiveness ceremonies. In offering a food offering with a pleasing aroma to the Lord. Now listen. And if a stranger is sojourning with you, or anyone is living permanently among you, and he wishes to offer a food offering with a pleasing aroma to the Lord, he shall do as you do. For the assembly, this is the covenant assembly, the church, there shall be one statute for you and the stranger who sojourns with you, a statute forever throughout your generations. You and the sojourner shall be alike before the Lord. It's amazing. One law, one rule shall be for you and the stranger who sojourns with you. Again, very fascinating. One law, a law of forgiveness. Remember, this is prior to Christ coming on the cross, offering forgiveness to all. Remember, for the Israelites, they had to sacrifice animals. Blood needed to be spilt. Atonement primarily through the blood of animals. And again, this was one of the unique ways in which that separated Israel from all the other nations. It was a unique cult, a unique rite for forgiveness. And yet God amazingly says, for the strangers, foreigners that are with you, same law applies. Wait a minute, wait. I thought the Old Testament was only for the Israelites. What do you do with a passage like this? Where a stranger and a foreigner living in Israel gets the opportunity to go to the temple, offer sacrifices, and actually is promised forgiveness and atonement. Those are astounding words. That God would want to provide forgiveness and atonement. That God would provide an opportunity for a relationship with Him that was only given to Israel at first. But now God's slowly cracking open the door to allow many, many more to come and receive His blessing. Even people from Bloomington and Korea to receive His blessing. Here we see the foreshadowing of this door opening up to all God's grace. Clearly this points forward to Christ's work. Christ died not only for Israel. Christ died for all. For the foreigners too. That's a great passage. But another very interesting passage is 1 Kings 8. You may know it as it's King Solomon now. King Solomon built this grand temple in Israel. Solomon's temple. One of the greatest and grandest temples of all time. As he's dedicating the temple, he prays on behalf of his people. So he gets to the temple as part of the king. As the king, he prays that God would use this temple to bless Israel. Specifically, a lot of what he prays for is that when the people of Israel, who will sin, he says, forgive them when they pray to you. Forgive them. Bless them. Be merciful to them. So it's a profound prayer. If you've not read this in a long time, read Solomon's prayer and what he prays for his people. But then he concludes with this in verse 41 in 1 Kings chapter 8. He says, as for the foreigner who does not belong to your people Israel, but has come from a distant land because of your name, for they will hear of your great name and your mighty hand and your outstretched arm. When they come and pray toward the temple, then hear from heaven your dwelling place. And listen, this is the king of Israel saying this about foreigners. Do whatever the foreigner asks of you, so that all the peoples of the earth may know your name and fear you, as do your own people Israel, and may know that this house I have built bears your name. Solomon was a missionary, even in the Old Testament. And as he builds this wonderful edifice, representing the presence of God, primarily of forgiveness, of healing, of blessing, he includes the foreigner in forgiveness and atonement. So this is God's heart toward the international students in Israel and perhaps the international students here in Bloomington. This is what God expected of His covenant people, to imitate God in His love and forgiveness, in His provision and protection. So as I conclude this section about what the Bible says about international students, who are the strangers, the aliens and the sojourners in your midst? Who are the people that God has placed uniquely and providentially in your life? Who needs God's love and forgiveness, provision and protection? Now clearly, can you do this on your own? Of course not. But God's promises to us in the gospel are clear. Remember, Jesus came to His own, but his own received him not. Jesus came to his own, but his own became strangers to him, aliens to him, rejecting him, despising him in their sin. And yet he comes. He lives among them. He loves them, ultimately forgiving them to the point of his own death on the cross, taking their sin, the sin of strangers and aliens, their shame. Why? So that they would never be strangers and aliens before his Father. So they become by faith sons and daughters of the King, the King of Kings. And look at his own life. If you look at the gospel, how many times did Jesus go out of his way to reach the marginal, the strangers, the aliens? In the book of John, one of the first people that he goes to is a Samaritan woman in chapter 4. This half-breed, bastard children. The Jews hated the Samaritans, had nothing to do with them. Yet God, Jesus, goes to a Samaritan, not just a man, not a Samaritan priest, but a Samaritan woman who has a history of adultery and unfaithfulness. And what does he do? Does he condemn her? No. What does he do? He goes to her and says, "Can I have some water to drink?" And he tenderly, compassionately steers the direction toward where she can get eternal living water. This broken, shameful woman that has to get water in the heat of the day because she couldn't get it during the morning or the afternoon where most of the women would come. This lonely, isolated, broken woman, Jesus goes to her and embraces her, loves her. He did that with many others, with a Roman centurion, the Romans who had occupied Israel. These slave owners, the oppressors, Jesus shows compassion to the Roman centurion. So we have evidence upon evidence of God's own embrace of the stranger, including you and I. And so this is what God calls us to do, to embrace the stranger. So we've learned what the burden is. Secondly, what the Bible says. So what does it look like to embrace the stranger? Let me offer you some modest proposals. First, some general ways in which you can start embracing the stranger, now that you have the motivation. Where do we begin? Where should I start? I don't want to assume that you're already doing this, and so if I'm repeating things that you're already doing and you already know, I apologize. But let me just share some things. First, some general advice, and then secondly, some particular advice to Asians, Far East Asians specifically, because of what I know about that culture and worldview. So first, some general advice. In the form of various B's. All right. First, as you approach your task and this wonderful privilege of embracing the stranger, embracing the international student, first, be humble. It goes without saying you don't want to be patronizing because of their culture and customs are different. For example, you may be surprised when students from the Philippines come to your house when you've invited them, very graciously, of course, to a meal in your home. And they take out their handkerchief and begin to wipe down the seat where they're going to sit. And then right when they sit for dinner, they'll wipe down your plate and wipe down the utensils before they eat. What is your response? What are they saying about my cleanliness and my hygiene habits? Actually, nothing. In some parts of the Philippines, that's their cultural way of making this place more warm to them. They're saying, "Now I'm making this part of my home." That's a cultural way of them being more comfortable. It's not hygienic at all. So you can't freak out when they start cleaning your forks and knives before eating. It's just cultural. So be humble about these unique customs. But that leads me to my second one, which is, secondly, be diligent. Be diligent and learn what you can about their life, their culture, their customs, so that you don't look like the ugly American, so to speak. And I'm in that category too. So be diligent and learn more. We'll talk more about this in the specific section when I talk about what I can teach you about Asian culture. But as you get to know them better, third, be careful. What I mean by careful, don't offer immigration advice unless you're an immigration attorney. One of the worst things you can do as a church or as a Christian is to offer immigration advice that actually goes sour. And I know you want to be helpful, just be very careful. I've just learned that from personal experience. Not me personally, but having to come in and help international students at the seminary who got really bad advice from the well-intentioned person at church. "You ought to do this, you ought to do this." I'm like, "No. You can go to jail." Fourth, be prepared. Be prepared. Prepare yourself. Be prepared. Learn, for example, how to share the gospel with people with very different worldviews. Like, listen to this wonderful lecture by Julius Kim on evangelism in the 21st century, for an example. Learn two ways to live. Utilize resources like Christianity Explored, which is a Bible study program for seekers, where you go through the book of Mark with people who are just interested in Christianity. It's like an 8-week study through the book of Mark about Christianity, answering two primary questions. Who is Jesus, and why did he have to come? So you take international students to a study like that, Christianity Explored. So be prepared for those type of opportunities, whether it's one-on-one evangelism, two ways to live as a program, or like a study like Christianity Explored. Fifth, be balanced. Be balanced in your approach to international ministry. Don't think primarily in terms of just conversion. Of course, we want to see that. But conversion is God's work, not yours. You're an instrument, clearly, of sharing the gospel. But conversion itself is, I don't know if you knew this, but the Holy Spirit does that. And last time I checked, I'm not the Holy Spirit, and you're not the Holy Spirit. So let the Holy Spirit do that. What do? We share the gospel, clearly, bring them to church, and then love them. So be balanced. Think about sharing your life with them. If Jesus is a major part of your life, if the gospel is important to you, it'll come out in the way you live, the way you decide, how you choose things, how you interact. Oh, I hope. You'll eventually share Jesus. I think conversion will hopefully occur as the gospel seeds are planted and as you love them. If Jesus and the church is part of your life, share that with them. So be balanced. Don't think about just conversion, but think also about relationship. Sixth, be hospitable. Especially with Asians and other countries, hospitality is one of the best ways to develop relationships. Another little cultural tidbit you might want to know. Let's say you get invited by an international student from Africa, primarily from Zimbabwe. So you go over to his house, he invites you to a meal, you have a wonderful meal together, and then it's time to go home, and he actually walks with you about half the way to your house. Let's say you're walking distance on the campus or something like that. A little bit odd, but it's very hospitable. So then you return the favor, and you invite him to your home. Then after a wonderful meal, what you thought was a wonderful meal together, you say, well, it's time to go. And you show him to the door, and you say, thank you for coming. And you close the door, and he goes home. That's all you would do, right? Then all of a sudden, you meet him later on campus, and you're walking around campus, and you meet him again. Joe, how are you doing? And his reception to you is very cold, distant. And it seems like he's mad at you for something. And you can't figure out why. What did I do? What did I say? Do you know what you did wrong? You didn't walk back with him to his home. See, in parts of Zimbabwe, the culture of hospitality and relationship building is you show how much of a friend you are by how far you walk with him back home. So he walked with you half of the way home, which shows like he actually considers you more than just an acquaintance now. He wants to be your friend. And then basically you just said, I don't really want to be your friend. I'm just going to see you out the door now. Thank you very much. That's what he understands. I'm not saying it's right. I'm just saying that's his worldview. And if you don't understand that, you can unnecessarily create difficulty in your relationship building. So if you happen to have dinner with a Zimbabwe person, make sure you walk him back home or take him home or something like that. He'll really appreciate that. Because immediately in his world, in his way of viewing reality, he's like, wow, this person really cares for me. Same thing with Asian students. For Asian students who are away from home, the clan and family, especially over meals, is very sacred. In fact, the Korean word for family is shikku. The root word there, shikku, ku means group. Shik is a word used for food. That's how important food is in the lifeblood of the Korean, as you can still see. That's why I eat White Castle, because I'm a foodie. But culturally, one of the best ways to enter into the life of a Korean national, is actually sharing a meal together. Even more so is if you invite them into your home and they eat a meal with your family present. It's very special. You're inviting them into that inner circle, that sacred circle of family, But like, wow, they consider me family, that they would share a meal with me at this table. To you, it's like, ah, it's just a meal. Not for the Korean. It's very important. So again, understanding these cultural things of hospitality can grant a lot of open doors and bridges that we take for granted here in the United States. And I think we need to redevelop an understanding of food hospitality in our culture. So where am I now? I don't know what number I am, but whatever number we're on, be patient. 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. 7. I don't have numbers. I have bullet points. Sorry. I have these little dots. 7. Be patient. Developing relationships take time. You know this. How long did it take you, for those of you that are married, how long did it take you to finally convince your spouse, please be my husband or please be my wife? What have you? I pursued my wife for 2 years in college. And she finally gave in. Persistence works. No, that's not the moral. Developing relationships can be hard when it seems like it's oftentimes very one-sided. International ministry, you're going to feel like you're giving a lot of yourself. Resources, time, talent, and treasure. But remember what motivates us. It's the gospel. The gospel teaches us that of Jesus, He gave His all to us. So that because of that embrace. Similarly, God calls us to give our all. Not foolishly, that's not what I'm saying. But that's got to be the attitude. Give all for the sake of the other. So we have to be patient. If the gospel motivates this relationship, be patient. Plant the seeds of love and relationship. And don't worry if they don't seem to come to church every week because of your wonderful meal. It's okay. Be patient. 8, be realistic. Now, these are a lot of advice. I'm sorry. Be realistic. Not everyone in the church, and maybe not even everyone in this room, needs to be involved with international student ministry at the same level. Some may be very hands-on, sharing your time with them, your talents with them. Some may be better behind the scenes, providing meals or helping with rides. Some may want to be just prayer support that undergirds this ministry. So all of this is more important than you realize. We're all working together at different parts. Satan does not want more people in God's kingdom, especially those who are influencers in their own countries. Satan will fight you and your efforts. Remember, our fight is not against flesh and blood, but against the powers and principalities of this present evil age. So be realistic. You don't all have to be doing the same thing, but that leads me to my next advice, which is be prayerful. It is spiritual. It is spiritual warfare, and not just a physical one. You're fighting against Satan. Ask God to break and open hearts. Ask God to break and open your own heart with a burden for the lost, to see the world and His children as God sees them. Have special times of prayer for the marginalized people in this community that need the love of Jesus. Pray for the Spirit to change hearts of stone into hearts of flesh. Pray for wisdom in your words and deeds. Pray for all these things that I just said, for humility, diligence, balance, patience, protection. And pray for more prayer. And then, second to last, the penultimate be united. This is something that the whole church can get around. You don't all have to do the same thing, but imagine the dynamic kind of ministry that would occur if the whole church is behind something like this. You take it on as one of your projects as a church because of the unique place where God has planted you, Bloom, where you're planted. The whole church is committed to embracing the stranger. It can be a powerful witness to the gospel of grace. And then lastly, be strategic. Be strategic. Have a plan and execute on it. Try different strategies and then assess their value and their effectiveness. Again, that's just wisdom. Plan for it. Go online and learn how other churches are doing it, how other ministries are doing it. We're called to be wise stewards of our time, talent, and treasure. Thus, planning for certain goals and evaluating whether you met those goals after a certain amount of time is actually smart and wise and being a good steward. If you're going to start a ministry like this, plan for it, evaluate it, and grow it, and make it excellent. It's not the most important variable for this ministry, that is its success, but it is something that will help us all learn and grow in our outreach and ministry. So there are things that you can do in terms of being strategic at the church level. You can have special days of worship for the international student, a day I know some church has they call it the Andrew Day. Andrew was a disciple that invited his friends to see Jesus. So there's a specific Sunday geared toward bringing strangers and aliens into the church service. Specific discipleship and mentoring programs. Non-English language small groups, for example. Finding people who have the ability to speak Mandarin or Korean. And having specific small groups or Bible studies in that. An English language program. Using Christian resources. Having them read, for example, that wonderful book, Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe. And discussing that. And what are the themes involved? Learning English. Conversational English classes here at the church. Sports, activities, culture nights, service projects. What about on campus itself? Again, discipleship and mentoring. Hospitality on campus. Finding occasions to celebrate culture in community. What about in your home? Hospitality, of course, I've mentioned them. Especially at holiday times. Not only just U.S. holidays. But find out, what are the Chinese holidays? What are the Korean holidays? When is Diwali, an Indian holiday, important Indian holiday? Celebrate that with them. Within reason, of course. Don't offer food to the idols. You know, don't sacrifice cats and drink their blood, but for example, but you know, within reason, celebrate their culture. One of the major holidays in Korea was actually Buddha's birthday. I didn't know that until I lived in Korea for a year, about 5 years ago. I did a year abroad as a visiting professor at a seminary in Korea. And this one Thursday, everybody was out, and there's all these lanterns all over the city. Beautiful. Like, what in the world? They thought I was a stranger. I was a foreigner. They thought I was an alien. Don't you know it's Buddha's birthday? I'm like, oh yes, Buddha's birthday. And they're all out having picnics. Because I think it's in May or something like that. But what a wonderful opportunity. You celebrate Buddha, I'm going to celebrate Jesus. Let's have a birthday party for Buddha and Jesus. And compare and contrast, shall we? Why not? There are ways to do that. And then I think finding ways to incorporate international students into your kind of just routine as a family can be very profound. Can many come here without family? Very isolated and alone. The more you incorporate them into just your regular patterns of family life, they're profoundly moved. Their hearts break. When they see the kind of love you share with your children and your family, they're like, wow, Christianity does make a difference. That's absolutely right. And now some particular advice for Asian students. I'm going to ask Pastor Adam to pass out this, one of the pastors to pass out this chart that I've adapted for you by a leader of InterVarsity. InterVarsity is one of these campus ministries that have been very intentional in ministering to international students. And while I don't always agree with everything that they do, they've been very helpful in providing some resources for international ministry. And one of the resources that they've given, Paul Tokunaga, one of the leaders at InterVarsity Press, who's of Japanese-American descent, one time was asked to put together how Western culture and Eastern culture differ in some major areas of life. And it's very interesting when you start going through this, and I this so resonates with me, because I'm like caught in the middle. Like on one hand I'm Western, on the other hand I'm Eastern, I'm this weird mutt. Frankly, it's weird being Korean-American. I feel like I don't belong anywhere. I go to Korea, frankly, I don't quite belong there. I can speak the language, I understand the culture, because I've spent so much time in the United States, much of my cultural values and ways of doing things are very American. But then I come here, and there are certain Korean things about me that are still very culturally Korean. So I'm in this no man's land, strangely enough. So on the one hand, it can be quite depressing, but viewed in the right way, it's actually very encouraging and inspiring. Because it reminds me that this world is not my home. I'm just but a pilgrim passing through. And my true heavenly residence is somewhere else. And so I'm not in either culture. I'm not in between. I'm not in both. I'm in beyond. And having this kind of eschatological pilgrim experience really helps me understand my Christian walk. And so while this can be helpful for us as we minister to Asians, just keep that in mind as well, that we're all pilgrims. We're all strangers and aliens in this land. This world is not our home. But if you are going to meet Asians, you need to know a little bit about their culture. So here we've listed, I haven't given all of them. I put down some of the things that are pretty interesting. Not very hard to guess, but in the West, the individual is more highly valued than the collective, the corporate. So in the West, the self, The personality, the uniqueness is all valued. Being this rugged individual, manifest destiny, right? That's being American. The Eastern countries and Eastern culture does not really hold to that. Again, these are generalities. I've met many Koreans who are rugged individuals, who are very selfish and self-centered. That's, I think, just because of sin. But generally speaking, culturally, there are some things we can talk about. So remember that. For the Asian, the group, the team, the collective whole is more important than my individual way of thinking. Furthermore, in terms of hierarchy and equality, the West thinks of all of us being equal. The only thing that defines us then that's different is our skill set, perhaps our education. But primarily we're equal. Very different in Asia. Asian culture is much more hierarchical. So one of the first things I learned as a Korean, I didn't even realize I was doing this. Every time I walked into a room filled with Koreans, I'm already scanning the room to see who's the oldest, who has the most education, who's the most rich. As a young kid, I already developed those skills. Just from watching my parents and just that cultural. Because immediately I have to know how to respond and react to different people at different levels. Because of the Confucian world's social structures that so influence our way of thinking. Confucius basically said that for society to really work well, you have to remember these five important relationships. The king and his subjects, the father and the son, the older brother, younger brother, etc. There's five different relationships. And as long as those relationships are maintained in unity, you have a unified society. So as a result of this hierarchical structure, one of the first things I do is like, who's the oldest? Like even just today at lunchtime, two of these young men took me out to lunch, and they bought me lunch, which went totally against my cultural ways of thinking. As the older brother, I must buy lunch. And them insisting on buying me lunch was an affront to my dignity. But being the good Christian that I am, I allowed them to serve me. I sacrificed my dignity as the older brother. And I let them. Is that good, Pastor? Thank you. So, again, Christianity has been really helpful for my cultural things. So, self-assertion, deference. This becomes really interesting. You know, in the West, I think there's a value placed on volunteering yourself, expressing yourself whenever you want, pushing yourself forward, advancing yourself in the corporate world. In Asia, you would never have that. That's why Asians who come to America to work in corporations, or Asian Americans even, that get into the corporate world, they have a hard time feeling like they're valued, and they get passed up a lot for promotions, like my older brother. Very interesting. My brother went to Stanford for his undergrad, went to Kellogg for his MBA. He's a smart guy. Very bright. But over the years, of 20 years working in the corporate world, he works in the high-tech industry, he worked for IBM, Red Hat, Intel, etc. He would always get passed over. And he couldn't understand why. Because for him, it's always about meritocracy. If I do my work really well and I produce the outcome, I should get promoted. But what he didn't do is he didn't know how to schmooze his bosses. You know what I'm talking? That kind of very wise way of relating to your bosses. So they when they have to choose between one or the other, they choose the guy that they're friendly with, talk about sports with, etc. My brother thought that's crazy. I should get advanced for who I am and what I produce. And every time you get overlooked. What he didn't realize was how much his culture impacted his way of thinking. Similarly, for a lot of Asians, even in our churches today, a lot of Asian people in churches are bypassed for leadership roles because they don't push themselves forward. They're always pushing others forward. And so a lot of Caucasian pastors who have Asians in their midst think, yeah, I don't think he could be an elder or a deacon or a leader. He's very passive. I don't think he's got the skill set. It's not a matter of skills. He may have the best skills of all, but culturally, he never wants to talk about himself. He always wants to be deference, show deference, and push others forward. So when you understand things like that, those kind of cultural dynamics, it changes the way you approach Asians. And then some very interesting things, time orientation versus event orientation. A lot of Asians don't mind if you go over like me right now. Many of you, because you're Caucasian and Western, you're going, when is he ever going to finish? Because you're counting the minutes. You said you were going to start at 2. I think we said 3:30, didn't we? With Q&A. And this guy keeps talking and talking. Because as a Korean, Event is more important than time. And we could talk about that. Africans even more so. When you say worship is going to start at 10, 11:30, 12 o'clock, 12:30, maybe we'll start. And the American missionary is just pulling out his hair. Going, when is this worship service ever going to start? Then they worship for like 3 hours. And that's just the singing. We haven't even gotten to the sermon yet. And so again, cultural values, cultural worldview is very important. And there's more. There's more. So the takeaway, what's the takeaway from all this? Some of these specific cultural values. Again, you want to develop relationships. And you want to develop programs that work in conjunction with these unique worldview and values. Not against it. Again, many of these worldviews and values are not sinful or not sinful. These are just wisdom and just ways of living. Now, of course, if it's sinful, don't. Obviously, that goes without saying, you don't compromise the truth. But if you can understand their values and their ways of thinking, utilize that. Utilize that culture for your advantage. Build relationships in light of that. Develop programs in light of that. So in light of the fact that Asians value what? Asians value authenticity. They value sacrificial service. They value clarity in relationship. They actually value age. So when older people in the congregation minister, they value that rather than just peers. They value non-direct ways of speaking. They value communal life, not individual life. They value this holistic understanding of leadership and service. That it's not just what you do from the pulpit, let's say as a pastor, but what you do at home with your family. When you invite them to your home, many Asians will not only watch what the children do, but how you interact with your children. And then they'll say this, is this a man I can trust? That's why Korean businessmen, when they do business with Westerners, you know what they do? They go drinking with them. Strangely enough, I'm not promoting drinking with your international students. But, interestingly enough, why do they do that? So the Western businessman will come, say, I've got this contract, I've got the best contract for you. I want to buy 1 million of your units for this amount of cost. Do you want to do business with me? And the Korean, you know what he'll say? Don't worry about it. We'll talk about that later. Let's go have a drink. And the Korean businessman will take the Caucasian or Western businessman to the bar. And then they'll just drink and drink and drink. But the Korean is watching the white person the whole time, the Caucasian, the Westerner. Why? To see how he responds when his tongue gets a little bit more loose. Because frankly, for the Korean, that's when your true self comes out. Sometimes I use that too, not alcohol, but I take my church people to play golf with me. I love golf, and their true self comes out when they play golf. And it's a wonderful opportunity for ministry. Seems like you've got some anger issues. How can I pray for you? So that's interesting. That's what Koreans do. Why? Because they want to see how genuine you are. Is this a man or a person that can be trusted? If I can trust you as a person, the details of the contract are secondary. Of course, we'll be wise and do a right contract. But they're looking at your character. And so especially in the home, what a wonderful opportunity to display the power of the gospel in that kind of context. And it could profoundly change their lives. So again, here's the burden. The Bible calls us to do it. Jesus' own life calls us to do it. And hopefully through this, you're going to learn how to embrace the strangers even in your own midst so that God would be glorified through your ministry and your love to the stranger. Thank you. Thank you for your patience with me. It's clearly my cultural side that caused it, so it's not my fault. It's this Koreanness in me. I'm sorry. So blame my country, not me. Any questions? Yeah, just a few if you have any. Yes, Pastor. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, the honor and shame.
Yeah,
it looks different in different ways. But let's say you have several international students that have become more part and parcel of your life here. Rather than saying, you need to do this, you need to talk to five of your friends and bring them to church. or you need to do this, you need to share the gospel with them. Rather, what they would want to do is for you to do is kind of subtly go, wow, I notice there's a lot of international students that you know. What do you think we can do? Well, do you have any ideas? Then they feel valued rather than being just told what to do. So that's one way of indirect versus direct ways of communicating about church. But then other ways too, when they do something wrong. Let's say at one of your events, one of the international students just does a cultural faux pas. I don't know what it may be. Instead of letting the ladies go first, that's a very American way of treating, but that's not very Asian. It's very expected for the men to go first, in Africa too. And so many of these young Asian men will go to the front of the line, bypassing all the ladies, some of them even pushing them out of the way. They're not being rude. That's just their culture. That's what they're used to in their home culture. Then they come here, and so you go up to them and go, why did you do that? Why are you being so rude? That kind of direct confrontational approach to something that he did wrong will shame him. And he'll probably never come to your church again. He'll probably never come because of the tremendous amount of shame he faced. Rather the indirect approach, kind of the side door. Go, hey, I don't know if you know this, but you know, American culture is pretty funny. You know, I would rather go first in line because I'm hungry. But did you know in America, just out of deference to the weak and the vulnerable, we let ladies and children go first. I don't know. What do you think about that? And maybe a few weeks after the event or something like that. Not right at that event. And so in that way, then he'll kind of, in his mind, he'll process and go, oh, man. And he'll feel it, but he won't be ashamed by it publicly. So what you've done is you've helped him to see his problems and his issue, but in a non-direct, non-confrontational way. Frankly, sometimes a very loving way. You know, as you know, there's more than one way to skin a cat. Not that I've ever skinned a cat before. But I'm trying to learn this whole English language Americanism thing. I've been learning, as an American, that there's more than one way to skin a cat. To catch a mouse. To build a better mousetrap. And for my children, especially, sometimes the direct approach is very good. There's sometimes, especially with my older daughter, I have to take the kind of the indirect route. Say, you know, honey, I've been noticing just kind of the way you treat your younger sister. I wonder, you know, just, what? Other than, stop it, you know? Why are you so rude? You know, so that's just one example. Does that help?
Yeah.
Now, as you can see, that can lead to problems by being so indirect. You can leave them with, did he get it? He keeps doing it. I don't think he got it. That's the problem with indirectness, too. That sometimes can be very frustrating for a Westerner. But just tell it like it is, Pastor. Just give me the black and white. And Koreans and Asians like it more gray. Yeah. Yes? Yeah. Utilize the natural kind of bridges you already have developed. For example, I know that Pastor Rich, I think he teaches at Indiana University, has biology classes and things like that. What a wonderful avenue and a bridge to meet international students. So if the church and Pastor Rich has this heart for international students, here's an opportunity to create a program, let's say an international dinner night. We have different people in the congregation who have international experience, and we'll do a dinner especially for, and then you'll start inviting different international students, let's say in your class or in our classes or what have you. That's one way. You can do programmatic things, structural things like that, but you can also do spontaneous things. Frankly, just be open to the Lord providing opportunities for you to meet international students. Are you going places? Are you doing things where you rub shoulders with internationals? And once you do, God will provide the doors. And if you're sensitive to that, you'll go, huh, hey, wait, I remember this talk that Julius Kim gave about international students. Maybe this is an opportunity for me to invite them to church. Huh. So those spontaneous ways, as well as structural ways, I think there are ways to start building bridges to the international community. Yes.
We have an ESL ministry in our church, and my question is directed to what you said about immigration issues, and we go over our way not to be able to, we're not trying to find out about them, we're not trying to spy on them or find out where they're from or if they're legal or not, but we went to a conference at Moody, and they said, well, it's Christians, so we need to help them to do the right thing.
Sure.
And once we befriend them, they do start sharing things with us.
Sure.
Yeah,
it's a hard question. In Southern California, we do a lot of ministry to Hispanics. And that always creates trouble, not trouble, creates challenges for us. Because as we're sharing the gospel with many Hispanic people in Southern California, many of them are there illegally. So what's the right approach? The short answer is, I don't know. But this I do know. What we have done is not, we haven't barred them from coming to church. Because everyone's allowed to hear the gospel. But what we have done is we've actually consulted with specific immigration attorneys to help us. What are some things that we can do to protect ourselves, but also help them without unnecessarily causing damage to them or to their families? Because of the unique immigration laws that exist today that are not the best, you know, you don't want to break up families, for example. You know, so you have these children that were born in the United States, have certain rights, but their parents are still illegal. So by reporting them, immediately you separate family. Are we ready to now step in and help this family out? Very difficult. And again, I don't know, have all the answers, but we do have contact with specific immigration attorneys that know the California law as well as the federal laws, and make sure that we're working together with them to ensure the best possible outcome, not only for our church and our ministry, but also for these illegal aliens. Yeah, that doesn't really answer it, but that's one thing that we've tried to do, and then learn from our mistakes. Yeah. Yeah, Cynthia. Sure, sure. Now keep in mind that even though the Asian values more indirectness and subtlety rather than direct commands, they also understand that they're in a foreign country with different culture themselves. So they'll give you, most foreigners will give us a lot of freedom, for lack of better words, for the dominant culture to pervade. And so they don't expect you to come up to the pulpit, or Pastor Rich to come up to the pulpit, then all of a sudden give like an Asian-esque sermon. I'm not even sure if that exists, frankly. They know that when he comes up, he's going to be himself. And they want him to be authentic. However, having said that, so can he be direct? Absolutely. But at the same time, when dealing with Asians on a one-on-one or personally, just being sensitive to the fact that that's a cultural value that I just need to be aware of, that may color the way that I approach them, deal with them, confront them, help them. But doesn't necessarily mean you change who you are. They'll smell that out too. You know, many foreign exchange students, internationals, are very sensitive. Because they're already the minority. They're already going to feel insecure. They're going to be defensive and scared. So they're going to come up and be very sensitive. And so in light of that, how can you help comfort them, encourage them, empower them? That's what we want to do. Already as it is, they're going to be sensitive. We don't want to be unnecessarily insensitive if we can help it. But sermons, Bible studies, and something, they'll understand. That's who you are. Yeah. So just being in balance. Yeah. Is that helpful? Thank you for your time. Appreciate your patience with me.